Hello, my name is J. Lewis Mills, for On the Level with J. Lewis Mills. I need you to do me a favor. I need you to lend me something. I need you to lend me your ear, and I need you to lend me your common sense. I need you to come join me. I need to talk to you. You need to talk to me. It's about time that we let it all out. Join me. I want to hear from you. Hello, thank you very much for joining me once again on the level with J. Lewis Mills. And you got me, J. Lewis Mills. So I wanted to first start off by thanking everybody. I got a lot of feedback from last week's show. Some was positive, some was not understanding, but I appreciate it all. My email address, jlewis.mills@outlook.com. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. Listen to the show. If you have any questions at all or any feedback, just keep it coming. I love it all. Thank you very much. So, this week, pretty interesting. I was doing some research for another show that I'm going to be doing in a couple of weeks. And one of the people I was speaking with happened to mention that they know someone that I may be interested in talking to. So I asked, you know, okay, who is it? And the gentleman's name is Patrick Rowland. He lives in Phoenix, Arizona. He has written a book called Unpacked Sparkle. I took the time yesterday and today to read through it. It's a very interesting book. Let's go ahead and bring Patrick in. Patrick, how are you doing, sir? Do we have Patrick?
I'm here.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing very well. Thank you very much, first of all, for joining me. I greatly appreciate you coming on to talk about your journey as well as your book. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Patrick, why don't we just start with you telling the listeners who you are, a little bit of your background, and then we'll get into talking about your book.
Okay. So, my name is Patrick Rowland. I am a Phoenix resident primarily. I've lived here since I was about 11 years old. I released a book recently called Unpacked Sparkle. It's primarily about the two-year journey I went on after I found my partner dead in our home in Phoenix in January of 2014. It was about a year and a half before gay marriage was legal throughout the country. And when he died, basically I was treated very poorly by the police and exceptionally poorly by his family. And it basically forced out of my home and disinvited to his funeral and, you know, just kind of not allowed to grieve, not treated like a human being, you know, that kind of thing. And basically what happened is a lot of that anger that I had about the situation, I turned inward and I had a pretty significant drug problem for about a year and a half, which culminated in a trip to Las Vegas. In May of 2015, I was there to go to see Britney Spears and Mariah Carey in concert, but by this point, I was such a wreck on drugs and alcohol that I basically holed up in my hotel room the whole time, and toward the end of the weekend, it was a Saturday night, I realized that the window in my hotel room could open, and I decided that I was going to jump out of the window. Now, mind you, I was on the 26th floor of a casino, so I was pretty, like, if I would have jumped out, I would have died. For whatever reason, I called my mother back here in Phoenix, and screamed and yelled at her for a solid hour, I think. She and I weren't really getting along that well. And what's very interesting about that whole thing is my mom has dementia, and I don't think I ever told her where I was in Vegas. But somehow she found me, and about 5 minutes after I got off the phone with her, there was a knock on the door, and it was the police and fire and all these people. And basically what happened was I got hospitalized against my will. And, you know, that whole experience, you know, I joke, you know, in the book I call it being Britney Spears, which is kind of ironic because I was there to see Britney Spears. But, you know, what happened in that hospital was I realized that I had to stop being a victim, and I had to figure out how to get my life back, and I made the necessary steps to do that. And, you know, I started putting one foot in front of the other. I think that what happens when somebody dies is that we forget about ourselves, and we forget that we have lives, and everything is about this person that died. And I forgot that I had a life, and I forgot that I had a life worth living, and that I deserve to live. And I forgot that he would have wanted me to live, and he would have wanted me to be happy. And so I started making the necessary steps to kind of get my life back. And for me, like, because of the whole funeral scenario, and because I had been pretty much high, pretty much from the day he died up until this point, I had never really dealt with his death. I was just, you know, I was numbed out the whole time. So I started with some really good grief counseling, and my grief counselor was like, you know, I can't be the only person that that you're getting help from. You know, you have some pretty substantial substance abuse problems. I think that you need to go to a 12-step program too. And by this point, I had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and stuff like that. Like I had been sober in my 20s for a period of time. I had been sober, like, in the time between. Actually, I tried to get sober before he died, and I tried to help him get sober too, and he didn't want to get sober. And, you know, one thing I learned from that is that you can't make somebody get sober if they don't want to be. But then I tried to get sober, like, in that year and a half, too, and I just couldn't get sober. I couldn't get over the grief, really. But what happened was is that I was just in such a kind of victim mentality that I think people picked up on that, and I met a lot of, like, kind of opportunist-type people during that time, and there were a lot of people that took advantage of me. So my feelings about the program and about 12-step were that's the kind of people that were there, and I didn't want that. I didn't want to be used. I didn't want to be treated badly. So I didn't want to be in a 12-step program. And so I was really reluctant, but I trusted this woman, and I said, okay, fine, I'll go to one meeting. Well, what ends up happening is, so I'm getting this grief counseling, and this grief counseling is really, like, saving my life. Part of the thing that was really good about it for me is she had me working in a journal, and I'm a writer. I've always been a writer, so I think that for the first time I'm, like, actually writing all these things that I had been bottling up, and a lot of that journal is actually what became the book. But, you know, I'm writing all these things out, but then I'm starting to go to these 12-step meetings, and then one meeting on Friday becomes two meetings a week, and then it's three meetings a week, and then it's four meetings a week, and then I'm starting to make friends, and then I'm starting to make more friends, and then the next thing I know, I'm on a committee planning something, and then the next thing I know, I'm on another committee, and before I know it, I'm so immersed in this program that I'm doing something every night, and I have this whole new life, and, you know, like, it just, like, snuck up on me. Like, I didn't even, like, if you would have told me that, like, that this is the life that I would have, and that I would have, like, a whole new group of friends, and, like, almost like a adopted family in a way, and that my life would just turn around, and that I would write a book, and that I would, you know, tell people how to get sober and live a well-intentioned life and be a role model and be successful and, like, all these things back, you know, when I was, like, standing up on that windowsill, like, that just didn't seem like it was a possibility for me. But the one thing that I've realized is that anybody can take their pain and make it their power. All you have to do is believe in yourself, and you just have to love yourself. It's interesting because when I was a little boy, So my favorite singer of all time was Whitney Houston. I always loved Whitney Houston. And my favorite song when I was a little boy was The Greatest Love of All. And I actually used to sing it in talent shows. And you know that song, you know, Learning to Love Yourself is the greatest love of all. And it's such a simple, simple song. And yes. But, you know, you get older and you go through life and, like, bad things happen to you and you forget to love yourself. And what happened to me in that hospital in Vegas is I was just like, dude, you've got to, like, wake up and love yourself because ain't no one else going to do it. So, you know, I just decided
how
to start loving
after,
myself. What?
How long after your partner passed away, and let me say, you have my sincerest condolences on that.
Oh, thank
but
you.
But how long after your partner passed away did you end up in Las Vegas?
It was about a year and a half later.
Okay. So for that year and a half, did anybody talk to you about getting help? Did anybody try and get you to get help and you just wouldn't listen? We weren't trying to hear them, or no one tried to reach out to you in that way?
No, as a matter of fact, I went to rehab about 2 months after he died. So he died in January and I was in rehab in March of that year. Like, I wanted to be sober. I just, you know, a lot of times we say, like, in our sobriety speak, I say in quotes, we say that people aren't done until they're done, or you don't stop until you're ready. And I just don't know that, like, we also call it, like, our bottom. We're hitting our bottom or whatever. I don't know that I had hit my bottom until that whole experience in Vegas. Like, you know, like, there's something very, like, horrifying about being carried out of a popular hotel on a stretcher on a Saturday night while all these, like, really dressed up people are, like, staring at you. And I mean, it was a well-known hotel. Well, it was the Palms on the Strip. And I mean, it was a Saturday night and people were staring at me and I felt really embarrassed. And, you know, I had to, like, sit in this, like, county hospital. Like, all the people in this hospital were, like, straight up, like, bonkers crazy. The first night I was in the mental institution I was in, like, they put you with, like, just totally, like schizophrenic people. And, like, you know, I'm mentally ill, I'm bipolar and stuff, but, like, you know, the people that I was with were, like, way not, like, I'm very high functioning. The people I was with were not high functioning. And, like, you know, they eventually, like, moved me, like, to a more, like, high functioning, like, unit or whatever. But, like, I realized in that horrifying, like, moment, like, oh my gosh, like, my behavior has caused all of this chaos. And if I don't get my act together, like, it's just going to get worse from here. And the problem, like, the thing is that that wasn't the only time that I had been hospitalized in that period of time either. Like I got hospitalized, actually, the day of the funeral, I got so bombed that I ended up in a hospital. So, yeah, I mean, people were concerned about me. I mean, there were people that, you know, like, part of the thing that was so cool about being able to write the book is that, you know, when I was going through that grief process, I didn't think that anybody cared about me, because I think that one thing that grief does is it makes you feel like you're alone, and it makes you feel like nobody cares about you, because that's what depression is, right? Depression is isolation. Depression is your head telling you that nobody wants you around, go away, you're useless, whatever. That's all stuff that's in your head. But, you know, it's not real. Like, there were people that were, like, around me, loving me and helping me the whole time. I just couldn't see it because I was so depressed. And that's why there are, like, five or six people that I wrote a chapter about, and the things that they did and the ways that they helped me through my grief. Because there were people that were rallying around me the whole time. I just didn't know it at the time. So, yeah, I think people were concerned. I'm just not sure that people really knew what to do. I think that, you know, there was one friend, so I have this really, really close friend from college. Her name is Amy, and she's very, and she's always been very, like, in your face. Like, that's just the way she is. She always, like, for example, like, I didn't come out to her, like, she told me I was gay. Like, that's just how she is. That's always how she's been. She's just very, like, abrupt. And, you know, she was just very, like, in my face the whole time, very pushy, very, like, you need help, you're a mess, blah, blah, blah. And I just wasn't having it, and it made me feel bad, and it just didn't, like, really work. Like, and I'm not saying that, like, tough love doesn't work. I think that it can work. I just wasn't really there for that at that point in my life. Like, it's weird, like, I was in such a victim stance, though, at that point in my life. I think that now that I stand in, like, the power of who I really am, because I know who I am and I know what I'm capable of, and I know that I can achieve a lot and be a lot because I have conquered so much, you know? And, you know, like, now I can handle, like, that kind of talk because I'm tough, you know? But I just think that it depends on where you are at that point in your life or whatever, you know?
Okay. So the first step in getting help is realizing that you do need help. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, step one is we realize we were powerless over alcohol and drugs. So yeah. Yeah, you have to admit to yourself that you have a problem, yeah.
When you came to this point in life and you said, you know, my partner would want me to be living a better life and I'm going to do this, is this something that you felt in the beginning? Is this something you felt like you were doing for yourself? Is this something you felt like you were doing for your partner? Or is this something you felt like you were doing to prove people wrong? Or did it not even, did none of that even come into your mind?
You know, I think the thing that's really special about this time for me, because, I mean, when I say this time, like I said before, this isn't the first time that I've tried to be sober. I mean, so I tried to get sober about 6 months before he died. And I tried to get him to do it too, and he wouldn't. And then in between that year and a half, he died. And when I eventually got sober, there were like four or five other like times when I'd get 30 days basically, and then I'd like give up and like start using again. So let's say five times I had like 30 days, and I would just give up. And so this time has always felt different. This time has always felt like the time. I don't know why. It's very hard to describe. Like, even back in the hospital, I knew that I was going to make it this time. I knew that everything was going to be different this time. To answer your question, it's a little bit of everything in a way. Like, this is my time. Like, you know, I am doing this for me. But then on another level, like, in doing this for me, I'm also doing it for my parents because I have two elderly parents that need me to be an adult now. So, like, I get to, like, show up for them now in a way that I wouldn't be able to if I was still a mess. You know, I get to show up for my friends in a way that I couldn't if I was still a mess. I get to show up at work in a way that I couldn't. I get to show up for my community. Like it's for me, but it ends up being for everybody else, and it ends up being a tribute to him. Because I get to live the life that he couldn't. Do you know what I mean? He couldn't live this life. I mean, he couldn't even be out. Like, he never came out of the closet to anyone. The fact that he even got in a relationship with me is pretty astonishing because he was really, really, really closeted. And he was really, the way he was brought up, he was really brought up to believe that who he was wrong. And so, you know, it's a miracle that he and I even got together and, you know, to be living this way, to be happy and joyous and free and, you know, to just be living. I mean, I am living, and I don't think that he really, like, I don't know that he got to ever really do that kind of living in the closet bubble that he lived in. You know, I think that in a way he got some of the life that he deserved toward the end, because at least he got to finally be himself, at least around me and my family. But, you know, he never got to tell anybody in his life who he was. He never got to introduce me to anyone. I'm sure that had to weigh on him. I'm sure that was hard on him, you know. I had to be hard to be somebody's. I mean, he was a brother, a son, a father, a friend, an uncle, and none of those people knew who he really was. That had to like weigh on him. That I don't have anything weighing on me. Like, not only, I mean, it's not just about being gay. It's about being bipolar. It's about being a drug addict. It's about being a widow. It's about being an alcoholic. Like, I don't have any skeletons. I don't have any secrets. I'm free. You know what I mean? And nobody, yes. Like, nobody can take anything away from me, and nobody can push me in the closet, or, you know, I live a life of freedom and joy.
At what point in your transformation did the thought of, I know you say that you were writing a journal, but at what point in your journey did you decide that you were going to write a book?
So I had always wanted to write a book. I've been a writer like my whole life, my whole career. I was a journalist, and, you know, I've always been a writer. I got super inspired when I had about 90 days of sobriety. I took this like weekend seminar, and somebody told me that the guy that wrote Fight Club, his name is Chuck Palahniuk or something like that. Anyway, the guy that wrote Fight Club, they said that he took that course and he wrote Fight Club as a result of taking that course. And I was like, well, if he can write Fight Club, then I can write a book too. And I did. I wrote that book. But at the time, I only had like 90 days of sobriety, and I was like, who the hell wants to read a book about sobriety and being sober from somebody that only has 90 days of sobriety? Plus, there's a lot of stuff in that book that I wasn't really sure that you know, I wanted like out there, because, I mean, you know, I'm like in mental institutions and the back of police cars and getting kicked out of like pricey hotels. And I mean, it's not glamorous. It's pretty like sad. But, you know, it's what happened. And
was it easy to come to grips knowing, like, when you finally made that decision of when you were going to write this book, was it hard for you to come to grips that, you know, all of your situations were getting ready to be revealed? Or did you see it as, you know, this is just part of the healing process?
Well, it's definitely hard, part of the healing process, but you know what else it is for me? It's an insurance policy. Like, now that all my stuff is out there, like, I don't have anything that's going to, like, cause me to, like, go back out there and go back to that life again. Because, you know, a lot of the reason why people relapse and stay in that pattern of use and, you know, drug abuse is because they never really get honest and they never really deal with all their stuff. I have dealt with all my stuff. I don't have stuff anymore. So, like, you know, I'm not saying that I don't have stuff that comes up. I mean, like, life still happens, and I still have to, like, deal with life as it happens. But as far as, like, all that stuff that I used to be ashamed of, that used to, like, keep me down, that, like, kept me down for 40 years, like, I set it free. So, like, the book is an insurance policy. Like, I don't, like, I'm not going to write a book with all my darkest secrets in it, you know, and then go do that stuff again. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yes, I do.
It was a way for me to, like, kind of, it's like an insurance policy. I'm trying to protect myself from being an idiot again. You know what I mean?
Okay. I get that. I totally understand that. Let's talk about, I want to know more about the name, but then I also want to also know about the journey of getting the book actually done. So
okay.
Let's just start with the name.
Okay.
Unchecked Sparkle.
So the name.
Explain to the listeners where that came from.
So the name, that very last time I did drugs in Las Vegas, I bought this pair of really obnoxious sparkly shoes. You know, I don't know if you've ever watched America's Got Talent when Nick Cannon was the host, but he always used to wear these like really bright sparkly shoes. And, you know, I was going to go see Mariah Carey, so I was like, well, I'll get sparkly shoes, and Mariah Carey will notice me in the audience. Well, obviously, like, you know, by the time the Mariah Carey concert happened, I only went to that show. I left after six songs, so I didn't even give Mariah Carey a chance to notice me because, you know, I wanted to go back to the hotel room and do more drugs. Like, I didn't even, like, that's how messed up I was. I didn't even care about the whole reason why I went on this trip in the first place. So I have these, like, obnoxious sparkly shoes, and ironically, they become, like, this, like, thing here in Phoenix. I have, like, six pairs of them now. You know, I started wearing them to, like, meetings and stuff, and people in the fellowship, in the 12-step fellowship that I go to, just really respond to them. Like, I guess they're whimsical and hopeful, and people just really like them. So I just have kept wearing these sparkly shoes. So that's the sparkle. And then Unpacked is, my partner's nickname was Pack, because he was a Green Bay Packers fan, so I called him Pack. I never identify him in the book because he was not out and he would not want to be identified. And even though I wrote this tell-all book about, you know, our relationship and his death, he's never identified. And the way that I did that was by calling him Pack, because that, you know, keeps him safe. Sure. And since he's gone, I've unpacked. So I've unpacked my sparkle, realizing that even in somebody's death, you can find life. I say in the very first chapter, his ending was my beautifully broken beginning. And I didn't realize that, you know, at the time. But, you know, I think that when somebody really, really important to you dies, it really makes you take stock in your life. And, I mean, obviously, once you get out of the grieving process, because, you know, I wasn't doing anything in that, but once I was able to get out of the grieving process and start moving forward, like, you know, he had really, really influenced me and really made me look closer and, you know, think about the things in my life that were really important and really, you know, I want to live a good life because I want to live the life that he can't, you know? I want to do the things that he can't, and I want... You know, the funny thing is that he was always very proud of me, and, you know, I'm pretty flamboyant, and I always have been, and he liked that about me, and, you know, he always... he used to play this song for me it's called Ambitions, and the chorus goes, "If somebody's going to make it, that somebody ought to be you." And I like to think that, like, he's probably wherever he is, like, playing that song, only now I'm, like, actually making it, you know? And you know, even though he's not here anymore, like, I feel him with me because I'm making all these dreams come true for myself. And I'm, like, living a life that I never even imagined possible because I can and because I want to and because it's worth it and I'm worth it. So that's where the title comes from. The sparkle is kind of... getting your life.
Okay. When you got to, when you finished the book, it was finished.
I sat on it for a long time.
How long is a long time?
I didn't do anything with it until I had 9 months of sobriety. So I wrote it at 90 days and I didn't do anything with it until I had 9 months. I don't know. So I'll tell you the story. I was doing other work at home. I got up to go to the bathroom. I came back to my computer, and there was a pre-populated email on my computer with a publisher's email populated in the email thing. I didn't do it. And I took that as a sign from the universe or whoever that I was supposed to write this woman about my book. So
I
did.
This was 9 months, right?
9 months, yeah. Okay. So I sent this woman on this pre-populated email that I didn't do. I just said, "I wrote this book. I'd like to talk to you." And she wrote me back. And so, long story short, she became my publisher. And then, so that was when I had 9 months. And then from 9 months to about 18 months, there was editing and stuff. And it took us about 9 months to get out. It came out. I had 18 months when it came out. And I have over 2 years now. So.
Okay. Was it... was it hard to find a place to sell your book?
Well, no. Well, yes and no. So the really amazing thing about the fellowship of any 12-step program is, like, once you're in it, like, you have these people that just, like, love you. Like, I mean, these people, like, no matter what you do, like, you have these people that are cheering for you and loving you. And, I mean, these people, like, I never imagined that I would have just this constant, it's just a constant source of love and encouragement, and it's just amazing. And I had, so, you know, a lot of first-time writers, like, you know, they're lucky if they sell, like, 4 books, 5 books, whatever. Like, you know, I decided to have, like, a party, a launch party or whatever. I used to go have lunch every day at the sports bar across the street from where I work because, you know, my partner was a jock, kind of, and he liked sports, and this place reminded me of him, and the wait staff was always really nice to me, and I actually started writing the book there, so I'd written some of the book there, and anyway, so, you know, I just, you know, I didn't know if people would respond. I didn't know, and, you know, I had this opening party, and, you know, like 80 or 90 people came, and I sold like 60 or 70 books, like, the very first day. And apparently, like, that just doesn't happen. And, you know, then over the next couple months throughout the fellowship, like, it just still kept doing really well. And then, you know, I ended up getting an agent, and, you know, she's been helping me get the word out more, like, in a mainstream way. And so I've got this big showcase on Friday in Phoenix at a bookstore called Changing Hands, and I'm actually going to be reading selections from the book there and signing and doing a Q&A, and it's kind of a big thing because, like a lot of first-time authors don't get that kind of exposure. And, like, I got like, a write-up in the local, like, arts newspaper, and, like, so it's starting to, like, even though it came out, like, 7 months ago or whatever, like, it's just starting to get some kind of, like, traction right now, like, in the newspapers and stuff like that. So I don't know anybody from what?
How is that this newfound attention that you're getting? How is that helping you as far as delivering the message that you want to deliver?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we never think that these things that break us when they're happening are going to be these things that end up kind of making us, you know. And we never think, you know, I certainly never thought that, you know, when his family, like, denied me from going to the funeral and stuff like that, like that really broke me. Like, I never thought that I would get over that, one. I certainly didn't think I would do anything positive with it, too. And the fact that I've turned around this, like, really ugly kind of monstrosity of an event in my life and turned it around into the most positive, beautiful thing that ever happened to me, like, that's amazing to me. And then on top of it, it's been received as well as it has. It's just beyond, like, you know, it's critically acclaimed. Like, every book review I've gotten has been really positive. Like, the New Times, which you're from here, so you know what the New Times is. Like, they said really nice things about it. Nobody.
How does that, like, make you feel when you read the reviews and they're positive? What does that validate for you?
Well, I mean, I think the thing more than anything is I think that it makes me feel like that's such a hard question because, like, I think the reason I'm very passionate about, like, telling my story because I feel like there are people out there that are, like, maybe in the same position that I am in, you know, maybe not the exact same scenario or whatever, but there are people out there that are broken, and there are people out there that don't know how to fix themselves, and there are people out there that think their life is over and think that they don't matter and think that they can't make it and, you know, whatever. I get it. I was there. I tried to jump out of a window. You know what I mean? But the thing is that, like, I'm proof that you can, like, turn your life around and, like, kind of become anything that you want to be if you just start doing the things you need to do to get your life on track. That's all you have to do, is put one foot in front of the other and just start trying. That's all you have to do. And it's hard at first. I'm not saying that week in that hospital was fun. It sucked. When I got out of that hospital, I was in Vegas. I didn't know how to, like, and Vegas to me is the Strip. That's all I know about Vegas. And I was not on the Strip when I got out of that hospital. So I had to figure out how to get home. I didn't know how to do that. I am not a street person, so I didn't know, like, about the bus and all that stuff. Like, I had to figure all that out. Like, by this point, so this is 2 years ago, and everybody's mad at me, and I didn't have any friends at this point because, you know, I was, you know, I did have friends, but for the most part, people were kind of done with me because I was, you know, annoying. I was sad all the time, and, you know, I had to, like, build my life back up piece by piece. And that's what it is. You have to build your life back up. But the thing that's been really magical about this whole journey that I've been on is people have responded to me in an amazing way, because they see that, yeah, I was this guy that was kind of like this sad sack loser that, like, everything happened to me. You know, I was like, I was a victim all the time, victim. But now I'm a guy that makes things happen. You know what I mean? I'm a survivor now. Like, yeah, all that stuff happened, but this is what I did with that stuff. I created almost, like, I created a brand in a way out of, like, turmoil and hardship, and I made it sparkle, which is just, it's crazy to me that, like, this is kind of what I did. Like, I don't know, and I don't know, like, and it's weird, like, it all kind of snowballs, and it all kind of, like, it's all a work in progress, like, it all just kind of happens, and I don't know.
What do you say to a person that is struggling with, some sort of dependency to either alcohol or drugs? They want to quit. However, unlike you, they didn't have such a tragic situation happen to wake them up. And they just don't have that strength. They don't have something like you had to look at and say, you know what, enough is enough.
Yeah.
What do you say to a person that wants to stop but just feels they're not strong enough to?
Well, I can tell you from experience that person that was standing in front of that window did not feel strong. I felt like a loser. I felt like I was over. I felt like I had nothing to offer the world. I felt done. I just was done. I didn't care anymore. I didn't want to be around anymore. I didn't want to disappoint people anymore. I just was done. I didn't want to hurt anymore. You know, that person didn't have any strength. And the thing is, and the thing for that person, that just let's call the window is a metaphor. So whatever your window is to whoever's out there, think about what your window is and realize that you have more strength inside you than you know, and that all you have to do, and it's a lot like faith. You know, they talk about faith is like a little kernel of like a mustard seed, right?
Sure,
all you have to do is have a little bit of love for yourself, just a little bit of love, and let that love start to shine from within and think to yourself, okay, I love myself a little bit, and let that love grow and let that love expand and realize that you can do it. You've got to love yourself first, because if you can't love yourself, nobody else is going to love you. I spent my entire life chasing people around trying to make them love me. And, you know, in the end, I did get someone that loved me, but, you know, he died. So in the end, it doesn't really matter whether he loved me or not, because he's dead. So, you know.
Does it really, though? I don't mean to cut you off right there, but does it really not matter? Because it seems to me part of the reason that you transformed your life was because of how your partner felt for you. So I mean, it wasn't even me in the relationship, but I don't see it as that dismissive. Do you really see it as that dismissive? Or is that just a defense mechanism?
No, it might be a defense mechanism. I never would dismiss him or how he felt about me or our relationship. I'm just saying that, like, I have to realize now that, you know, it's been 3.5 years since he died, and I'm not in a relationship, and I don't know if I'm going to be in a relationship. I don't know if I want to be in a relationship, but I do know that, you know, I'm a human being, and most human beings want to be loved, but you kind of have to love yourself first, or else how can you expect anybody else to love you? And I think the reason why people, you know, have embraced me the way that they have is that they see me loving myself, and it's infectious. When people see someone that's genuinely, joyfully, from the inside out, happy, it's infectious, and people want to be a part of that. And so, you know, people are drawn to that sparkle, I guess. You know, it's
something.
How do
you get through your hard days? How do you get through your tough days?
Now?
Yes.
Honestly, like, I would say that now I have such good friends that I don't have, I mean, I do have hard days. Like yesterday, for example, wasn't a great day, but, you know, I just texted my sponsor and I was like, dude, I'm having a tough time. And he's like, come over. And I just went over to my sponsors and we just hung out and talked. And, you know, and then we went to a meeting. And then by the end of it, like, I felt okay. So, you know, a lot of it, I think, you know, to go back to your statements about somebody that's like in the middle of an addiction and they don't know how to get out. A lot of it is like about, like, making that effort to, like, get help. I think that when you're in an addiction, you get stuck in the pattern of not asking for help. And I think that one thing that I do really well is I advocate for myself. You know, I say what I am. You know, I'm like so upfront about what I am. Like, you know, like when I come, you know what you're dealing with. You know what I mean? And, sure. I'm also really good about advocating for myself. I think that, you know, as far as being, like, mentally ill, I mostly, you know, I'm mostly am managing my bipolar depression now because I advocate for myself. I'm able to say, whoa, this doesn't feel right. I need help. And, you know, I get help. I can tell you, like, today, actually, I saw my psychiatrist who prescribes my medication, and, you know, we had a pretty, you know, open talk. And, you know, part of bipolar depression is there's depression and there's anxiety. Like, I tend to have more anxiety than the average person. Like, when I have anxiety, like, I get, like, panic attacks and you know, like, can't move, and, like, that's what it's like. But, you know, I was telling him, I'm like, you know, I'm anxious, but I don't know that I'm anxious because I'm bipolar. I think I have anxiety because I have a full-time job, and I have a book that's out right now, and I have two elderly parents, and I have commitments in the program, and I have sponsees, and I have, you know, I just have a lot going on. I mean, I think anybody with that kind of commitment level in life would be anxious sometimes. I mean, that's a lot, you know? Just my parents alone, it's a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, you know, me personally, I think anyone that can come to grips with themselves and have that self-realization and say, you know, whatever it is they're doing, it's time to stop. I need to stop. I think... Once you've done that, you know, you in so many ways have won the battle because you are now thinking that way and you are now seriously wanting to do that, you know. Yeah. So I absolutely applaud the fact that you were able, no matter what happened to bring you to this point. I think it's great that you were able to bring yourself out. I think it's great that you had the wherewithal to write a book, and if I understand correctly, you actually sponsor people now, don't you?
I do, yeah.
How many people do you sponsor?
Right now I only have like two.
Okay. How does that work into your everyday life? Not necessarily your everyday life, but how does that work for you when you still have your hard days and you have a sponsor?
Yeah.
Is there ever a time that you can get a call from someone that you're sponsoring and then that causes you to call your sponsor?
Well, yeah, that does happen. I think, though, that for the most part, like, the reason why we have sponsees and the reason why we have a sponsor is, like all that work that we do with other people, like, it's the other people that we help that actually keep us sober. It's not really us that keeps us sober. It's the fellowship. It's the work that we do. It's the actions that we take. Like, you know, and I'll be quite honest, like, one of my sponsees has become one of my best friends. And, you know, if I'm having a hard time, I talk to her about things. I mean, you know, it's a reciprocal relationship. I mean, like, yeah, like, the idea behind it is, like, they look up to you and stuff like that. But it becomes a relationship. I mean, like I think that in some ways I help my sponsor just as much as he helps me, because I think that there's got to be some kind of, on my level, like, it feels good to help someone else. So I'm sure that on someone else's level, it's got to feel good for them when they know that they've made a difference in someone's life. You know what I mean? So,
yes.
You know, it's really all about, like, you know, one hand reaches out to the other, and it's all about kind of like, it's, you know, like, pay it forward, the golden rule, like, everybody's nice to each other. Like, this whole program, like, and it's really weird that I feel this way, because, you know, I was not a fan based on previous experiences, but it's really just this, like, you know, I just want people to know that if they're out there and they've gone to a meeting or tried it and had a bad experience, you know, keep trying and keep going to different meetings until you find the one where you click. Because I think that sometimes what happens is people go to one and they have a bad experience and they're like, oh, I don't want to do that. Like, you know, they close it off. Because I did that, you know. But I think that you got to realize that you're worth it. And, you know, there are some people that can be sober without the program and without doing this stuff. I don't think that I could be. I mean, I'll tell you, I have over 2 years now, and I'm as involved, if not more, than I was in the beginning. I still go to meetings all the time. I still have sponsees. I still talk to my sponsor every day. I still do service work. You know, I'm just busy. I have to stay busy. I have to stay in it. If I didn't, I would not stay humble. I would not, you know, I wouldn't be as healthy as I am right now, I don't think. I think it's that being grounded around these people that are like a community that keep me really grounded and sane. Like, it's like getting medicine every day. Like, I take my medicine for being bipolar. It's the same thing. Like, going to a meeting is like the same thing. It's like a spiritual medicine in a way. So I would say to anybody out there that has a preconceived notion because they went to one meeting and had a bad experience, or they know someone that's in the program and they don't like them or whatever, just try different ones. Keep going until you find the one where you click, because once you click, then everything falls into place. Does that make sense?
Yes, it absolutely does. What do you have coming up? What's coming up for Patrick? What's on your schedule? What's coming up?
So, my next big thing is Friday. I have the Q&A and reading at Changing Hands Bookstore.
Where
in
is
Phoenix.
That?
It's at 300 West Camelback in Phoenix. So it's like Camelback and 3rd Avenue. And then in 2 weeks, it's the CMA Arizona Convention. And I'm doing two workshops on grief there. So the convention, we have it every year, and it's kind of like the biggest event for our fellowship. What does CMA stand for? Crystal Meth Anonymous.
Okay.
It's the event that like kind of everybody goes to, and it's at a hotel, so everybody gets a hotel for the weekend, and we have a speaker that comes in from out of town, and we have really amazing entertainment. I was actually the co-chair of it this year, so I've been planning it all year, and I'm doing a workshop at it, and that's the 28th through the 30th at the drawing a blank. Sheraton.
The Phoenix Sheraton?
Yeah, the one at Metro Center. Four Point Sheraton, Metro Center.
Okay. And that's in 2 weeks.
That's on the July 28th to the 30th.
Okay. And this this thing that you're having on Friday, what time is it? And how can people, if you have to buy tickets, how can people buy tickets? Or do people just show up?
It's free. They don't have to buy tickets. I'm going to be reading selections from the book. I'm going to be answering any questions people have. I'm going to be signing books. So just be prepared.
What time should people start showing up?
Maybe 6:30. The whole area, like, it's a bookstore slash coffee shop slash restaurant slash bar. So the whole area is very vibey and fun. So, like, there's a lot to do, like, right in the vicinity of the area. So.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much, Patrick, for coming on.
All right.
Do you feel okay?
Yeah, I feel great.
Okay. Good. I hope to, you know, I'm going to be keeping tabs on you, and I'm going to, I'm rooting for you. And anytime you have anything to promote, you're absolutely more than welcome to come back and have another conversation.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for your support. I appreciate it. Can I just say one more thing?
Absolutely.
I just want everyone out there to know, whatever you're going through, you can get through it. Love yourself. Thank you.
Well, with that, I will say this. I had Patrick on my show tonight for one reason. Because he's a real person. He's not a celebrity. He's not a well-known author yet. He's not someone that's in the public eye. Patrick is someone that had a situation happen in his life. He took it upon himself, as well as getting help, but he took it upon himself to change his life. And that is more important to me than anything else. I am doing this show. I said in the first show, I am doing this show because I see and I know a lot of people that have so much potential, but they just don't want to either put in the work, they don't want to sacrifice, or they are just too scared of what could possibly be on the other side, or what is not on the other side. So when I run across someone that is making conscious decisions to better not only their life, but the lives of other people that are in their life, I applaud that. And I will always support that. So you're not always going to get someone well known on my show as a guest, but I hope at the end of every show, you understand the message that I was trying to convey. This show, the message that I'm trying to convey, or that I believe I conveyed in this show, is no matter what you're going through, you're going to have those dark days, you're going to have those hard times. Just know you're not the only one that has those problems. You're not the only one that believes life isn't where you want it to be. There's other people out there that are going through something just like you, you'll never know. But only you can look yourself in the mirror, sit down and have a conversation. I don't know what has to happen. For me, I had a 45-minute conversation. Call me crazy, don't really care. I had a 45-minute verbal conversation with myself after something happened in as far as my acting career went. And I said to myself, I don't want to be homeless anymore. Never wanted to be homeless, but I'm done being homeless. I'm done with people disrespecting me. And I am done living my life day to day. I'm no longer going to do that. So I had to take it upon myself to wake up and get up. So I am always going to be an advocate of somebody that wakes up and gets up. Because at the end of the day, that's really all you have to do. You have your journey. You need to be grateful for everything that brings you to your point of success. But you can't just sit there and say, tomorrow I'll do it. Tomorrow I'll do it. You have to do it today. I mean, literally, like today, like now. From this point forward, I would say if you're listening to my show right now, tell yourself, I have to do better for me. Once you start doing better for you, then you're going to be in a position to do better for others. Whether it's sharing your story like Patrick has done, whether it's giving more of your time to a particular organization that could use the volunteer help. You know, there are so many ways for people to give back without spending a dime. And there are so many ways to help yourself. That's my lecture for this week. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope that it was touching. I hope that it made you think. Again, I would really like to thank Patrick for coming on. As I said in the beginning of the show, you can email me at jlewis.mills@outlook.com. You can follow me on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and put my name. You can follow me on Twitter. Go to Twitter and do the same thing, Instagram and the same. I hope everyone has a great week. I look forward to being with you next week. I have a bit of a surprise for next week's show, so it's going to be a good one. So make sure you tune in. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for being here this evening. I hope you all have a great one. We are out. Are you inspired? Can I inspire you more? Come join me every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. on Station 2 here at BBS Radio. Let's get inspired together. Come join me. You'll be glad you did.